Welcome to Friday, and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to take the next hour to figure out what happened this week, what matters, and why. From the Northwest News Network, Phyllis Fletcher is here, and we have former Attorney General of Washington State, Rob McKenna, and we have best-selling, much-awarded author Sherman Alexie here. Thank you, everybody, for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
In the battle over who gets to use public lands, a jury has delivered an extraordinary blow to the government. Yesterday in Portland, federal jury acquitted all seven defendants in last winter's armed occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. Oregon Public Broadcasting reporter Ryan Haas was in the courtroom. Stunning, yes, Ryan?
Absolutely. Stunned silence was what happened when the verdict came down.
Why did the jury find Ammon Bundy and his partners not guilty?
Well, you know, we don't have an entirely clear picture, but from what we have heard from jurors, they said that the government just really failed to prove its case. They sort of swung for the fences with these charges and weren't able to prove that to jurors in the trial.
Why did the government charge conspiracy, which brought a not guilty verdict, instead of, say, just trespassing?
Right. I think that's the big question people are asking in hindsight. You know, it's conspiracy is sort of this antiquated charge that they tried to prove, and it requires proving the intent, right, that these guys intended to stop workers from coming to the refuge. And I think what the government was trying to do was trying to send a message. They wanted to get felony convictions on these guys, take away their firearms, and send a message before they go to Nevada. And I think at the end of the day, they missed on that.
So we used the word stunning at the beginning, Ryan. How do you explain to a listener who is as surprised as even you were that it seems like it's legal to come in armed and take over a government office?
Yeah, I wish I had a good answer to that. It just sent this message to these people that it is acceptable to do this to some degree. And they felt, a lot of them, you know, that I spoke to outside the courthouse, they said they felt vindicated. They felt like their protest proved a point that the federal government is overreaching and that they will continue with this movement. You know, I spoke to defendant Shauna Cox, one of the people in the case, and she said she's absolutely going to participate in more protests. She said we can do it peacefully, but she said that this has basically emboldened her to continue.
Well, that's one emboldened person. What do you think, because you've been living this. I mean, Oregon Public Broadcasting has really been covering this for almost a year, and you've got this podcast just devoted to this case and the issues around it with federal land. Do you think that this not guilty verdict will lead to more confrontations, more armed occupations, more seizures in this fight over public land?
I would say absolutely. I think that there's going to be, you know, it may not be something as dramatic as Malheur, but it may be. I think that people within this movement feel like we've won two victories now. We won in Bunkerville. The government backed off. We won in
Oregon.
This
is in Nevada.
Right, exactly. In 2014, we won in Oregon with these acquittals. And, you know, we're on a high. We can do what we need to get our political movement going forward and get these federal lands transferred to local control.
Except Ammon Bundy is still in custody. He still faces charges in Nevada from that armed standoff at his dad, Cliven Bundy's ranch. And there are seven other Malheur occupiers going on trial in a few months. So explain that.
Yeah, I think it's two different situations, right? Like, I think the prosecutors in Nevada have this, I'm sure, is a very clear message to them that you guys are up to bat and you better get it, right? They're going to take this case very seriously, and the government needs a win in Nevada to sort of tamp down the momentum that this movement has. In terms of the Oregon case, I would honestly be a little surprised if many of those people aren't if those charges aren't dropped, because what kind of political message does it say, I guess, if the leaders of the occupation are acquitted, but you try to pursue charges against some of the lesser known people that were at Malheur?
Well, could the government just reduce the charges to the rest of the defendants to trespassing, or it doesn't work that way?
I don't think at this point it works that way. I think that they're probably going to have to drop the charges.
Or
their defense attorneys are going to make very persuasive arguments for that to be the case.
Yes. Ryan Haas was in the courtroom. He's been covering this for Oregon Public Broadcasting. Ryan, thanks for joining us on KUOW.
Thank you so much.
So, former Washington Attorney General Rob McKenna, what legal precedent do you think this sets, if any?
I don't think it sets a legal precedent because every criminal case is unique in terms of who the defendants are, what the facts are, how the law is applied. To me, one of the most troubling aspects of this outcome is that it's another defeat for the U.S. Department of Justice and its U.S. Attorney's offices. We've already seen them fail to convict Troy Kelly. We saw them not only wrongfully convict Ted Stevens, but resulted in sanctions against some of the attorneys involved for hiding, exonerating evidence for Senator Stevens. They failed to convict John Edwards in his trial. I'd like to know what's going on in the system where they just keep losing big case after big case.
Well, it sounds like they made it too big. What if they had just gone for trespassing?
Yeah, they would have won on trespassing. I think they did overreach here. I agree. Yeah.
So I'm sorry, you were saying?
No, I think I'm just shaking my head. And I think in some of these other cases, they overreach. In other cases, like the Ted Stevens case, they broke the law in trying to prosecute the case. But there needs to be some soul searching at the U.S. DOJ, in my view, to look at why they're losing such big cases, especially when U.S. DOJ has a reputation for only prosecuting cases that are winners.
Sherman Alexie, the federal government, they control so much land. It's so outrageous. What's your take on all this?
Well, it sends the message certainly to a whole bunch of us that white Christian terrorists are acceptable. And I wonder if Trump's going to give a speech today that white Christian terrorists might be, deported back to Austria. I don't think that's going to happen. So it's simple. If this was a movement of brown folks, if it was a movement of African Americans or Native Americans or any other minority group, this is not how it would have ended. It certainly wouldn't end in acquittals, and it certainly wouldn't have ended as mostly peacefully as it did. We can't forget that one person did die.
That's right.
One person was shot. So this was
LaVoy Finicum, the spokesperson for the group, got shot outside the refuge in that traffic stop.
Yeah. So it was very serious. If I were them, if I were the people in this movement, I would be very seriously considering what the government is going to do next if this happens again. What kind of message the government is getting from this is that they might go in a lot more seriously. They might go in more aggressively and more violently. The government itself might.
Why would the government go in more aggressively?
If they can't win in the courtroom, are they going to try to win before they get to the courtroom? How are they going to stop this movement? And if, let's say, Hillary gets elected, the animosity in the country is just going to increase. And I think these kind of incidents are going to dramatically occur in much more dramatic and more often fashion.
Phyllis Fletcher, you have Northwest News Network reporters covering federal land issues. So we should remind that, yes, Nevada is 80% federal land. Oregon is more than 50%. But Washington State is 30% federal land. What are your reporters saying about the work they do?
Well, one of my reporters has been really interested for months on looking at states advocating for a lot of that land to be restored to state control,
right,
or put into state control. And then there are questions about, well, how expensive is that going to be, for example, when it all catches on fire, like happened a year ago. And so there's definitely that's an area that there's definitely still a lot of argument over, and it's not settled.
Is the thinking among the protesters that state control is better because state government is more likely to listen to your local ranching, mining, concerns, the people who work that land more so than the federal government is going to care?
That's definitely one thing that has come up, especially with ranchers. Yeah. And another thing I've wondered about in this whole thing is there room for, like, the Malheur type, Bundy dudes and Native peoples to somehow be on the, would they ever team up? I've wondered that, because there are certainly huge differences, and they were not on the same side in Malheur at all. But what if they were? Then what would happen? Then what would the federal government do? I don't know.
Let's talk about another protest this week over who gets to control land. Yesterday, soldiers and police cleared protesters from that camp near the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota, and the police used shotgun beanbag rounds and pepper spray and arrested 141 people. This is the Dakota Access Pipeline that would run through areas the tribe says are sacred, would desecrate areas. It would go under the Missouri River where the tribe gets its water. And Sherman, you told me you've got a lot of friends and a few enemies in North Dakota right now.
Yeah, and of course, they're telling a whole different story than what the media is covering.
Tell us about
that.
The
most sensational aspects are being covered.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the protest itself is 99.9% peaceful. In fact, the protesters themselves were trained in nonviolent actions, and you have to actually go through this training to even be there at the camp. So the idea that there's any violence that happens is going to be the result from the people in uniforms. That said, one of the big things that's happening is I think this is the beginning of a movement, certainly started at Standing Rock, but these climate change inspired protests are going to grow and grow and grow. I think this is going to be the new social battle, the new political battle, the new leftist movement is going to be against these old energy companies, these old ways of thinking about energy. I mean, I looked this morning at what the economy is doing, what the oil business is doing, and it's collapsing. It's a dying industry, and yet it's being propped up not for economic reasons, but for political reasons, for capitalistic reasons, that they're going to drain the very last penny out of this resource because that's what capitalism is. And the second it goes non-profitable, you know, the barons of oil are going to become the barons of solar overnight. I know this is coming. Rich people don't stay rich because they're stupid. The Standing Rock is going to be remembered as the beginning of a large movement. To use a very imperfect analogy, it'll be the stonewall of the environmental movement. I think that's what Standing Rock is going to be.
Former Attorney General, you look like you want to speak, so I'll just let you start. Rob McKenna.
Well, the question has been raised, why can't the Obama administration just stop this project?
Right.
The reason is that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has permitted this pipeline. It's gone through, because it's got its permits, we know it's gone through extensive environmental review and other kinds of review as well before it was allowed to go forward. If that review was flawed, if there are environmental impacts that weren't adequately analyzed, then there are procedures for pursuing those claims under the National Environmental Protection Act. But it's not like the Corps of Engineers didn't do its job. It's just that people aren't happy with the result because they don't want the project. So that's troubling because we live under a rule of law which says that we make companies and individuals jump through many, many hoops that are very, very expensive to get projects like these permitted. This one is permitted. This isn't like the other big pipeline last year that was blocked by, I guess, the State Department ultimately. This is a permit that was issued according to the law, and that's why the project is underway.
Are you saying any permitting outcome is the right outcome?
Oh, I'm saying that you have to have certainty. You have to, if you follow the rules and you get the permits you're supposed to get, being told you can't use them for political purposes, being blocked from exercising your rights under those lawfully issued permits because people don't like your project, is the opposite of the rule of law. It's just
And let's talk about the rights of the energy company. But where do you stop zooming out when you're looking at who's got the right? I mean, we're talking about legal claims. Tribes have legal claims too that have been shredded going back a long way. So
wait a minute. Are you saying that if I apply for permits for a project and I do everything I'm supposed to do, I spend millions of dollars to obtain them, I do the EIS, I meet all the requirements, that then someone who simply doesn't like my project can come in and say, no, you don't get to do it? We can't operate that way. It doesn't matter what kind of project that it is. So there are extensive legal procedures in place to challenge energy projects and every other kind of project on environmental grounds. This project apparently satisfied the requirements imposed on it, and it's moving forward. I'm not saying that the tribe members don't have a right to protest. They do. But at some point, you have to ask, when does the right to protest simply become an attempt to stop someone from exercising their own lawful rights?
Well, this pipeline is on land that was stolen through various government means. Treaties were broken. So I think what Bill was getting to is that this is also a protest based on broken treaties, that this land itself was taken in illegal maneuvers, or I should say legal in parentheses, maneuvers by the United States government, decades ago. So this is just another event in the long history of environmental degradations on Indian reservations, where their federal government and corporations cooperate, make sweetheart deals, campaign financing. Often the politician and the corporation are barely separable in terms of their interests, their families. And this has been going on the entire 20th century and 21st century. On my reservation, the uranium mines on my reservation were created.
Spokane.
On the Spokane Indian Reservation were created, financed, and abandoned in much the same way. The uranium mine on my reservation, one of them, is still abandoned, still has open pit mines in the area. The United States government has told us that we're not supposed to fish, hunt, or eat any of the plants that are in that region, which I guess assumes that deer like to stay in one place. You know, all the deer in the nuclear area are going to stay in the nuclear area. I guess the government is telling us, don't shoot the deer with three eyes. Or if you shoot them, don't eat them. So this is just another incident in the long history of the United States economic capitalization and exploitation of Native American peoples and land. And that is why so many tribes are involved. It's not just a Standing Rock. There are hundreds of tribes there, and every person there can tell you the story about how their reservation has been treated in much the same manner.
Yeah, a lot of Washington State people in North Dakota right now. Phyllis, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just keep thinking back to the, when the news came out about Malheur yesterday, just every person of color in my little people of color echo chamber on Facebook were like, not surprising, not surprising, not surprising. and just the parallels between the two, it was the first thing to come up. And just that this isn't how it's going to go down if this stuff with the pipeline escalates.
So when we started off with that being a stunning ruling.
Yeah, it's like all people of color not stunned. Completely unstunned.
No, none of us. Yeah, usually when the media, when somebody's stunned, it's almost always a white person.
How you doing, Rob?
I think you've earned your cynicism, so I respect it. I also think that we'll watch and see how many of the protesters at Standing Rock are prosecuted, what happens to them, and you have to be careful in making those comparisons because the facts are different on the ground. Mm-hmm. But like I said, you've earned your cynicism, so I don't question it. And I still understand how the U.S. DOJ blew the Malheur prosecution so badly.
Let's pause on Standing Rock, the pipeline, Malheur, more trials and more events to come up. We've got more of this week's news to cover with our panel. Happy to have Sherman Alexie and Phyllis Fletcher and Rob McKenna here. We'll be back in a moment. Continuing now with the Week in Review, there was a big twist in the Seattle Stadium story this week. The billionaire who had asked for some taxpayer money to build a stadium in SoTo said, okay, I'll do it myself. And then yesterday, the mayor, Ed Murray, said the city's looking at redeveloping Key Arena at Seattle Center. Phyllis Fletcher, does this mean the Sonics are coming back?
Not by itself. So the city council would need to approve this. And last time it was 5-4. So at least one person, if it were the same, they would need to be convincing at least one more person to the sale of Occidental Way. And it's the part of Occidental between Holgate and Massachusetts.
And have to give that street over to the stadium.
Right.
It would be at Center Court otherwise.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, I was looking at a map about this yesterday and remembering back to when I worked in the industrial district and that street and what it's used for and looking at what the port commissioners were saying about it and that it's not so much about that street. Which, the Port Commission doesn't have someone on the city council, but, their voice in this has been against it, partly because how it would affect everything around that street. And maybe you guys have been to this part of Occidental recently, but it's one of those streets that it's kind of used as an alley. But if it weren't available, it would be affecting a lot of things around it. There's rail that moves through there, freight of all kinds, just big, big, semis and things like that. So, yeah.
So this still has to go to the city council. They still right. cannot give this developer the street. He would like the city to waive the admissions tax and the business occupation tax. So it's not like the city would give nothing to the stadium
right,
effort.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So does this mean that the stadium opponents were right that you don't need to give billionaires money to get a sports team? Is that vindication, Sherman?
Yeah, let's
objection. Leading the witness.
Yes. Let's give let's give a free street to a billionaire, in the hopes that he somehow gets an NBA franchise that in no way at all has been promised to him.
Oh.
I want a team. I absolutely want a team. I testified in the court case trying to keep the team. But
I know you're one of the biggest Sonics fans I know.
But what amazes me personally, though, is the way in which so many of my friends, my basketball fiend friends, are completely abandoning their politics in order to support this. It's astonishing.
Oh.
Their love of the game is so strong, it completely blinds them to the machinations, the capitalistic machinations of this, and how at least on the surface, if not corrupt, it's certainly sleazy. I mean, Hansen was fined for interfering in another city's stadium deal.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he can be accused of being the most honest sort of business person.
But isn't he up front in this? This is a negotiation. Look, this is what I'm asking of you, and this is what I'll build. You know, the city, if the city wants it enough, we spend taxpayer money on stuff we want, right?
That's the deal. There are, I think there are two privately funded arenas in the NBA. So there is a precedent for this, and it is actually a very attractive offer, but it still has nothing to do with what the NBA wants. Mm-hmm. That's the bottom line, is what does the NBA want? Mm-hmm. And there's no evidence that they want to work with Hansen.
I think there is evidence of what the NBA wants, although it's not like they're sending out press releases about it. I think it's obvious from what they've been doing what they want, and what they want is a new arena. They don't want a remodeled Key Arena. They don't think it would be adequate. They want a brand new arena like they have in most cities in the last 20 years. And I don't think they really care how it gets paid for, particularly. If it's paid for partly with taxpayer money, fine. If a wealthy owner wants to step up and build it as they did in Denver, I recall, that's fine for them too. But they want a new arena. And I don't think they're going to make a team available until one exists or is inevitably going to exist.
So then why would the mayor be saying, the mayor says, quote, "I also remain committed to bringing the NBA back to Seattle," in the moment when he's saying we are issuing a request for proposals to refurbish the Key Arena at Seattle Center.
Look, they should refurbish Key Arena. It's an old building. Remember when it was the Coliseum?
Yeah.
I saw my first rock concert there.
Me too.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
What was the concert?
Heart.
From Heart.
Yeah. Oh,
Anna Nancy, awesome. Baby.
When I think of it, it wasn't quite my first, but Rush.
Rush.
Yeah. Presto awesome. Tour.
The power trio from, that's right, from Toronto.
Totally.
So you know, I understand why Mary Murray and prior mayors have said, look, we need to remodel Key Arena, but it's not going to get us a team. And I don't buy the port's arguments. Not that I think they're being disingenuous, but I'm not convinced by the port this is going to ruin the Maritime waterfront. Look, there are already two major arenas down there. There were big concerns about traffic and impacts on the port for them as well. What did they do? They built an overpass. It works really well. Mm-hmm. It moves truck traffic through there better than it ever did before because it moves it up and over the railroad tracks. Hansen is offering to put $20 million towards a Lander Street overpass. I haven't studied that particular project, but presumably it's designed to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Because there are already two major arenas there, I don't think this third arena is going to, by itself, take down the Seattle waterfront and destroy the Port of Seattle. I'm just not persuaded of that. The evidence isn't that strong for that idea.
Do you have none of those concerns about Seattle's working waterfront versus it turning into LA Live, the Hard Rock Cafe? You know, a lot of people are worried about that flip in Seattle.
Yeah, I mean, you should be careful and guard the waterfront, but let's look at it on a case-by-case basis, and let's look at the actual data to see if that would really happen or it's just a theoretical concern. After all, the port doesn't bear any of the cost of the arena not happening. They're only concerned about costs they might bear if the arena does happen. So it's no skin off their nose if we never get an NBA franchise, but it would be a good thing for the city. It would be a good thing for the region, and a lot of people, like your friends who are now abandoning their politics, Sherman, really want that team back. So, you know, look, but it's like any other amenity. Some people want the opera. Some people want, you know, an NBA franchise.
Our city doesn't have a good history of making wise waterfront decisions.
What are you thinking of, Sherman? Bertha?
So, we should have the most beautiful waterfront in the United States, and we easily could, and we don't. So I am suspicious of everybody involved.
It's usually a good stance to take. And that's public radio sports talk. We didn't talk about the Huskies being ranked number 4 or the Sounders winning in the playoffs or the Seahawks not being able to kick a field goal or win a game.
There's got to be a cloud in that silver lining somewhere. And we will find it here on public radio.
Or the World Series happening, by the way, where we have to watch Chief Wahoo every evening.
I mean, if there's any indication of the cultural disrespect of Native Americans in regard to who we are as people, our land, our history, the way we've been treated in the United States, don't think the Dakota Pipeline and the Cleveland Indians mascot are not related in the way we live in this country as Native Americans. It's exactly the same thing.
What's worse, the Washington Redskins or the Cleveland Indians?
For the mass, the imagery itself, the Cleveland Indians is far worse.
Chief Wahoo,
Chief
the
Wahoo
grinning.
Is actually just an indigenous version of Sambo. Mm-hmm. It is a early, late 19th century, early 20th century, absolutely racist image that is celebrated and is being broadcast nationally and internationally right now.
And the fans, the mostly white fans,
in
doing the war whooping.
In red face. Yeah, yeah. There are, you know, I haven't seen them on the TV. I think they're avoiding them. But certainly online, you can see there are dozens of people in Cleveland going in red face to a national sporting event.
Sherman, I absolutely agree with that. If they replaced Chief Wahoo with another image, something more dignified, would the name of the team alone cause a problem in the community, do you think?
I don't necessarily know.
Okay.
But I mean, I've made this argument before. If you really do respect Native Americans, you know, forgetting the fact of think about what was happening to Native Americans and how the country was treating us when these mascots were created. If you really do respect it, why don't you change your racist mascot into a Native in a suit with a briefcase? You know, it's a facetious argument. But if you truly respected us and saw us as equal members of society, then you would be portraying us in an actual honorable fashion.
Don't most Native people live? They don't live on reservations.
No, depending on the census, between 60% and 70% of us live in urban areas. Mm-hmm. Native Americans are white collar, just as white collar as any other ethnic group. And this idea that we're so connected to war, so connected to war as a metaphor, is actually also damaging to us. It's a stereotype that we inadvertently and mistakenly take up on ourselves as well. And the Cleveland Indians and the Washington Redskins and all these sports mascots continue that demeaning and inaccurate representation of who we are as human beings that not only makes non-natives look at us in a negative fashion, it also makes us see ourselves in a right. negative fashion.
Yeah. Should we get rid of all Indian mascots? We have tons of them just in this greater Seattle area, Braves and Warriors and Indians.
Every single one of them. My reservation high school, where I went until you know, eighth grade, is the Wellpinit Redskins. So even my tribe
still
does it to themselves.
To this day?
Yes. And wow. The high school where I went to, the farm town I went to, was the Reardon Indians. And I was the only Indian. So I went from the Redskins to the Indians. At least in my era there, they got rid of the mascot, the racist cheerleader mascot that Reardon had. But both schools could change it. Every school should change it.
You mean not use any references to Native Americans at all, Sherman?
No, I don't think we can trust people to
do it. Oh, I see. You're saying if they use a name, then it's too likely they might use a mascot or an image that's demeaning.
Yes. And it's amazing to watch the cognitive dissonance in people, supporters of mascots, when you place the racist imagery of other groups next to the racist imagery used in sports mascots and the way in which they can completely not see it.
Phyllis is nodding to
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I could totally see that. I mean, I've definitely made that argument and had friends make that argument, too, that, like, you know, there were baseball teams that were the such and such, you know, Negroes or whatever that was, you know, part of the Negro League. But you wouldn't do that now. Like, that's, you know, that would be, or like, what was it, the Ethiopian Clowns or whatever decades ago. But now that's obviously ridiculous.
So why doesn't Wellpinit change its name from Redskins?
It's the same argument about pride.
Huh.
Yeah. About pride.
Honoring.
Yeah.
Pride.
But really, they're confusing pride in the place where you're from with the symbol.
Mm. Yeah.
It's you know, in a religious sense, it's a false idol. And that's really what the worship of sports teams is religious. And trust me, I'm a member of that denomination. But what it is religious. And when you start messing with somebody's mascot in a blasphemous way, they start feeling like their mascot is a holy relic.
Mm-hmm.
So they feel like they're being blasphemed against by those of us who are trying to get them to change their mascot.
Mm. All right, we're going to move on with the week in review. I guess we'll close that out by saying go Cubs.
No way. We're an American League city.
Oh, okay.
I've got to root for Cleveland.
I root for the non-racist mascot.
Yes. More of the Week in Review with Phyllis Fletcher and Sherman Alexie and Rob McKenna just ahead. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Phyllis Fletcher, Sherman Alexie, Rob McKenna. Covering the news of the week and the campaign to replace Seattle's U.S. Congressman Jim McDermott got more interesting this week when one of the candidates, State Representative Brady Walkinshaw, ran an ad criticizing his opponent, State Senator Pramila Jayapal, for missing votes in Olympia.
Pramila even missed voting on the budget.
The most important vote of the year.
So she could raise money for her campaign in New York.
The ad also cited a rating service that called Jayapal the least effective senator in Olympia based on how much legislation she passed. Jayapal's campaign then ran its own ad with including footage of Donald Trump.
The attacks, demeaning women's accomplishments, enough.
So we've been talking about whether that attack othered Pramila Jayapal, whether it was overly negative. Rob McKenna, you've been the target of negative ads. When you ran for governor 4 years ago, I thought I knew who you were.
Sometimes you find a guy to clean things up, right? You get his info and you think, well, maybe. Then you start asking around and he isn't at all who he says he is.
Not at all who he says he is. And the ad goes on to say, Rob, that you voted to increase your own salary while trying to block an increase in the minimum wage.
Republican Rob McKenna, you're definitely not who you say you are.
Who are you? Did you find that ad? Did you find Brady Walkinshaw's ad out of bounds?
Well, look, the ad against me is just sort of typical cynical politics, right? Mm-hmm. They can't actually come up with evidence, so they just assert, oh, he's not who he says he is. Because if he is who he says he is, he would beat us. So he can't be who he is. We can't accept that he is who he is. He says he is. Now, with this ad.
Did they ask for your birth certificate?
No.
Your long-form birth certificate to prove you are who you say you are?
They did not. I would have been happy to provide it. But in the case of Walkinshaw's ad, I think we've got a Macbeth moment here where I think Jayapal is trying to change the subject because she doesn't want people to focus on her voting record. It's not the strongest attack you can make in the world, but no one is saying it's not factually accurate. They're just saying that for some reason, Walkinshaw doesn't have a right to raise her voting record in the state Senate or this rating of her either. This is one of the mildest attacks I can think of that you can bring against an incumbent legislator. And for Jayapal to go nuclear like this, she and her supporters accusing him of being a racist, accusing him of being a misogynist for criticizing her, really makes me wonder, not that she's got hurt feelings, but that it's a cynical ploy to try to change the subject away from the content of the ad.
Phyllis, part of the substance of the ad was she was off in New York,
oh,
in that far away, big city, which if there's dog whistling here, this is how it works, is that it's extremely subtle. And her supporters,
right.
Jayapal's supporters said that it's easier to make especially a woman of color into an other, that she was off out of state and raising money in New York City. I think that's the line of reasoning. Did that have any purchase for you?
No, I mean, like, no politician has ever done that. I mean, it's part of the job, right? You know, you prioritize and you might miss certain things. And if you're confident it's going to go the way you want it to go, oh, I got this opportunity over here.
But also in calling her ineffective, that she's a new legislator and there are ways to be to be effective besides having your name on legislation. And one of her supporters pointed out, in a Republican-controlled Senate, often what we have to do is take on to stop mm-hmm. things from happening.
Mm-hmm.
But I think her supporters are suggesting that, again, when it's a woman of color, it might be just subtly, almost unconsciously, easier to diminish the effectiveness of that person.
I guess. I mean, to me, it's all part of the same continuum of, are they then saying, well, he's not a person of color? I mean, he is.
He's of Cuban descent.
Right. So that's part of the dynamic, too. But, I mean, to me, I didn't take it as Trump-like at all. I took it as, you know, it's part of the same tradition of stuff that goes on all the time at this time of year. And I think that it might be especially painful for these particular two people because they're both Democrats. But I didn't see it as Trump-like. I saw it as very Seattle, where it's like they were all women in the commercial, like that was deliberate, all looking at the camera, all like this kind of, you know, even-toned kind of luxury type of thing, you know, and it's like, well, they were cast for a reason to do that. And some
why
of them
is that
were,
Seattle-ish?
And some of them were women of color, too. You know, like that was deliberate, too. Just that, like, you know, I'm disappointed in you. Like that, you know, that was the tone, right? Looking at the camera, saying that kind of thing, like, it's really disappointing that she would do this. You know, it's a Seattle style. It's not Trump-like at all. It's a very Seattle style campaign.
And it's entirely possible that the Jayapal campaign has made a tactical mistake here by overreacting or reacting the way they did and bringing Trump into it, which just isn't, why didn't they just compare Brady to Hitler? And I thought, oh yeah, Trump is less popular than Hitler, so that's why they didn't do it. But I really think what they've done is succeeded in bringing a lot of earned media attention to Waukesha and his campaign and his ad. More people are going to see the ad now.
Right.
So you have to be careful when you're calibrating your response to an attack ad, because you don't want to bring even more attention to the attack ad, and they've succeeded in doing that. I guarantee you more people now will pay attention to his ad when it runs than they would have before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I thought he ran a lame ad. I mean, Pramila's a friend of mine, and I haven't got a chance to talk to her because she's so busy about everything. But I would tell her, who gave you this advice and why did you listen? Which advisor suggested this? Because it's silly. The thing is, this race for us lefties, they're running for a seat in the district that is the third or fourth most liberal in the country, and it's the most liberal white majority district in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So really, between Brady and Pramila, it's pretty close to a coin flip. And it really, in a lot of ways, comes down to personality. And I mean, I've been making fun of their signs for months now.
Why? You know,
like Brady Pinedo, Waukesha. You know, my joke is when I drive by them to my sons, is my name is Sherman Redco or Alexi.
I felt really sorry for Pramila because all her signs appear to have been tagged, and then I realized, oh wait, they designed them to look like they were vandalized.
So it's. I mean, they're auditioning for a very specific audience, and they're so close in politics that their minute differences, they've exaggerated them into a Marx Brothers in Seattle sort of situation here. And I think they should both just shut up about these two ads, because I don't think it makes either of them look good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Rob, are you loving this? You're like,
Well, there's nothing nastier than a fight in a primary between two people who are so close together ideologically. Mm. Here, the primary is carried over into the general because of the top two system,
and so these
kinds of races commonly become very, very personal, and people overreact because there isn't that much to disagree on around policy.
Mm-hmm.
I am interested in what Brady may be doing here as well, though. In addition to trying to drive down her numbers, you know. 20% of the people in the 7th district have been voting for someone other than Jim McDermott. They've been voting for, when there was a Republican on the ballot, he would get about 20% of the vote as the Republican. So Waukesha knows that in a top two system, when you get to the general election, you got to figure out how you can attract people over from the other side. The same thing's happening in the state treasurer race statewide, where you have two Republicans on the general election ballot, and they're both vying now to bring Democrats over to support them in Democrat constituencies.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be that part of Brady's strategy here is to try to be appealing to, you know, non-lefty voters, because he needs to find a percentage somewhere, and they're there.
Mm-hmm.
So if he can make himself more, the more, it's about style, isn't it? He's more reasonable. Right? He wants to work across the aisle, willing to work across the aisle, which he has made part of his campaign. That might be a way to get those people to come over and say, well, between the two of them, I guess I'll vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't even talked about the other election. There is another election going on, by the way, in D.C. And did you hear just this morning that the FBI says it's uncovered new emails somehow related or questionably related to the closed investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server, and the FBI director says this is an unrelated case, and these emails have surfaced, and they, quote, appear to be pertinent to the investigation. This coming less than 2 weeks before the election. In Washington State, by the way, some people have already voted. I'm not saying this is a gigantic October surprise. It's just, and then I always think 2 weeks before the election, I think, well, it's not 2 weeks before a whole bunch of people already voted in our state.
I doubt it'll have much impact. It'll reinforce for Trump voters that they want to vote for Trump, or people who don't want Clinton to vote against Clinton. There's been so much about this. There's just so much smoke. It's hard for people to remember that there was ever a fire. And if she doesn't win, though, look out.
How do you mean?
I think the FBI might feel less constrained if she is not elected. Hmm. We'll see, though.
To go after her more, like they were, she was too powerful before.
I think she was too big to fail. That was the analogy I used when people were asking me to predict whether the FBI would go after her. I mean, they did treat her differently than they have other subjects of investigation. As has been documented. She got different treatment. The way the entire investigation was conducted was different than other investigations we've seen them conduct against elected officials. And keep in mind, the FBI and the US DOJ have had a very strong focus on public corruption cases for the last several years. Looking very, very diligently for cases and bringing quite a few of them because this has been a priority of the Obama administration. So if she doesn't win, we've got a couple of she's got a couple of problems. One is who's in the White House instead of her. But the other is, an FBI that, again, may feel somewhat less constrained. If she does win, I don't think you're going to hear much more about this, barring the release of something really dramatic, which would, of course, could be a game changer.
There are listeners saying, if he wins, it's like an 8% chance or something.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I have no doubt there might be something in the emails that's questionable, but I haven't read them all. But I've read the work of the right and the left who have read them all of her emails, and I have yet to see anything that indicates that she's anything other than a craven, manipulative politician, which we all knew beforehand. I have not seen any big reveals of some character. And this woman has been investigated continuously for decades. Is it because the U.S. Department of Justice is as incompetent as you said earlier in the show, Rob? It's a cynical letter.
The FBI director's letter.
Incredibly cynical. Yeah. It's so vague as to be pointless.
Hmm. But remember, there are lots of people who have been in public life as long as she has who have not been repeatedly investigated. The Obamas, for example, and a lot of others, the Bushes. I mean, there are many examples on both sides of the aisle who have not been investigated. The Clintons are kind of weird. I mean, it's kind of weird. They get into trouble. They've gotten into trouble for decades, prompting many investigations, whether it's sexual harassment, allegations of sexual assault, the Whitewater deal with financial issues, where the records suddenly appeared on a table in a corridor of the White House after they were missing. There's something about the Clintons. They just can't quite stay away from getting into this kind of trouble. And it doesn't seem to matter whether there's a Republican or a Democrat in the White House in terms of the investigations that are launched against them. But, she'll probably survive it, as you're suggesting, Sherman. I'm not saying it's going to change the outcome of the election because it's just too late.
I don't think there's anything going to be in the emails that would have changed it either.
Right.
I think the vagueness of the letter is what's intended to change the election, not the actual content of the new emails.
I think the bigger story here in general about newly disclosed emails is the stuff coming out in WikiLeaks, because the Russians have hacked the email servers of people and getting email of people like John Podesta. That is something we need to think a lot about. And maybe it'll get our country to take cybersecurity even more seriously, because what we're doing now isn't working.
That's what I was going to – I mean, can you imagine what is in the Republican Party's emails?
There's a lot of hand-wringing, would be my guess.
Yes.
A lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth.
I mean, I have Republican friends. I see their Facebook posts. So, and I'm sure you see some of your friends' Facebook posts, Rob. I can't imagine what they're saying in private. So, you know.
Well, we know what some of them are saying because Colin Powell's emails were hacked.
Mm. Yeah.
He said some rather unflattering things about Donald Trump. So, and look, I'm just saying as a general matter, this is very, very troubling. I mean, this is a strategy by Putin to elevate his own stature within his country. The Russians are really proud, as a sort of nationalistic pride, about their prowess at hacking, at cyber crime and cyber attacks. The Chinese do it. They just don't brag about it.
We'll tell you more about the Clinton emails and all the other election developments when they come to us. By the way, depending what falls this weekend, this might be the wettest October in Seattle history, about 9 inches of rain. This week, Seattle DJ Kurt B. Riley told me he's moving to Tucson. He's had it with the cost of living here, the loss of artists.
And for the longest time, I loved the rain, loved it. And I know I will miss the gentle rain of Seattle, but the last couple of winters have just been too hard for me. It's just been too much with work and the dark and the wet and not feeling well. It was grinding me down.
That's out of bounds. You do not talk about the rain while you're still here. Not cool. I once gave a weather forecast on KUOW where I said it's something like, it's raining, but it's going to improve. And I got phone calls. Don't you dare put your value judgment on my weather. And they were right. It's not okay. As long as you're here, you pretend to like the rain, or you just don't. If you have nothing nice to say about rain, don't say anything. Can we agree on that?
Yeah, I moved here as a kid, and it took me the longest time to figure out what they meant by rain turning to showers. Uh-huh. I thought, is it like one of those mythical that certain Native American or Alaskan tribes, Alaskan peoples have many, many words for snow. I've heard
many words for rain.
I don't know. I just like rain. What the heck does that mean? Rain turning to showers.
I don't know if the local tribes have a lot of words for the different kinds of rain. I'm going to have to ask. But the thing that bothers me most,
there should be a new thing that the Duwamish have 40 words for rain.
I don't know if they do or not.
No, either.
Great marketing for them. They should just say they do.
That's actually really good. Yeah. But the thing that bothers me is all the newcomers with their umbrellas. And I'm tall, so if I'm out walking, I spend the whole day dodging these rude libertarian tech people and their umbrellas. You know, I'm angry at the umbrellas that I'm dodging constantly.
That's why I got my soccer mom Helly Hansen coat, okay, and my slogger boots so that stay dry with no umbrella. Thank you.
I got to tell you, Bill, I'm a weather geek. I have a rain gauge at home. By the end of February, we had a full third of our annual rainfall total. By the end of February. I haven't gone back and recalculated based on what happened in October. But in Bellevue, the average annual rainfall is 36 inches. And we had two-thirds of that by March 1.
Ooh. Whoa.
Yeah, where I live. It's just, yeah. Even I was starting to make me a little crazy.
I'm going
to
picture you cleaning out your rain gauge, getting the moss out of there.
But he does have a good point about artists being unable to live here because of the cost. A lot of interesting folks. A lot of the interesting folks who were the reason I even moved here can't afford to live here anymore.
Mm.
So I may end up having to go back to Spokane to find the artists, which is going to be one of the great ironies of Washington State history.
Has he actually been to Tucson? I'm just...
If you're going to complain about the weather, of extremes of weather, everybody's going to end up in Santa Barbara.
Sorry, I see jumping out of the rain barrel into the frying pan.
Right.
Do they have the same conversation in Tucson where they say, you know what, after a while, can I just say, I got really sick of the sun. I hate it here. Does anyone? And people are piling on. Don't you dare. You know, like, I'm moving to Seattle.
I have 40 different words for sunburn in Tucson.
Right.
We are born to a certain weather.
Mm.
We are born to a climate.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to find that place for you. And Seattle's climate, I was born to it. I like the rain. I like the gray. It is absolutely conducive to being a bipolar, depressive, obsessive, compulsive, sad writer.
I lived in New York in the early 90s, and definitely Seattle had a reputation at that point. Like, that's where you go to be creative, and maybe the weather was part of it. I still remember hearing a girl on my college campus say, I'm just going to, like, move to Seattle and just, like, get my stuff together and, like, totally write. And I hope you did that, girl. I hope you did.
That's code for remove all other things that you'd rather be doing besides writing when you move to Seattle, right?
Yeah, take everything cool about New York, remove it, and then go to a place where it rains, and then you'll magically become a writer.
You won't, yeah, it's not the
it's a known fact.
That's a true fact, right?
Yeah.
There's no better city. I've never been in a better city in the country for writers than Seattle.
Is that still true? Because actually, the conversation with those artists is part of this series we're doing with people who are leaving because there's so many people coming to town. So we've been asking, why are you leaving and what do you want to say to us?
And now it's changing. In fact, the summer, my wife and I were driving. We don't have to be in the commute as every day as other people do, but we were separately driving in the commute on the same day and independently of each other for the first time since we've moved here 23 years ago. We both had the same thought. I don't know if we're going to stay.
Huh.
Now, that's not going to be for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
What are we talking, though? Port Townsend or Tucson? Like where are you?
Bellingham.
Oh, Bellingham.
Yeah. You know, we still want the rain.
Uh-huh. Right, okay.
Yeah.
We just, you know, we not just don't want Amazon.
Uh-huh. Okay. Isn't Amazon selling Thunder Boy Jr.?
Oh, like crazy.
All right.
I'm, you know, the thing is they do really well with my ebooks there too. They're always putting them on special. The conspiracy minded part of me just loves to think that, you know, the ebook division just loves putting me on sale and putting me on their bestseller list just to spite me. And so if they are, I enjoy their spite.
Is it like the internet version of a remainder bin?
No. It actually.
It's the opposite.
How dare you?
Opposite.
They're pushing it. It's volume, baby.
Units.
It's volume.
It pushes
all
units.
Right. Good.
Author, poet, filmmaker, all that stuff. Thunderboy Jr. is his latest. Sherman Alexie, thanks for coming in on the Weekend Review.
Thank you.
Rob McKenna, former Washington Attorney General. And what are you doing now?
I am who I say I am, first of all.
Okay.
I know that. And I'm practicing law with the great law firm, Orrick.
Excellent. Yeah. Phyllis Fletcher, your title at Northwest News Network, Poobah.
Yes, Poobah. That's on all my business cards.
Yep. Running the place, the Northwest News Network. And we're live tweeting at KUOW. And I hope you'll get a podcast. I know everybody's got a podcast, but I'm telling you, the Week in Review, The Record, Radioactive, KOW News. It's all there at KOW.org or go to iTunes or wherever you do your podcast thing. Thank you, everybody.
You're welcome.
Thank you.